Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, like I always say. It's just whenever I get round to reading and reviewing a book, I put the review up here on the podcast feed, which is a good job that I say there's no set schedule because it's been a few weeks since the last review. Of course, there's lots of reasons for that. I'll get into that in a minute. Actually, I've got quite a lot of feedback and things to talk about here at the beginning of the podcast, so maybe if you actually want to get to the review that I'm going to do of a Canticle for Leibowitz, you just need to skip forward a little bit, maybe 10 minutes or something. No, probably not 10 minutes. Anyway, so yeah, lots of good feedback. Thanks for the continued offers of people reading who want to read my novel or my novella, because I mentioned that a few podcasts ago, and of course people just seem to be catching up and they're still sending me emails saying, hey, I want to read it. Of course, I do have plenty of people who want to read it now, but keep sending in the emails because I'll put your names, and when I get to the next major edit of the novella, I will send it out to more people and I can get feedback from different people again. Another bit of feedback which someone sent me, which I thought was quite interesting, was they said, hey, I like your podcast, and they said, what are your top five all-time favorite science fiction novels? And of course, when I was writing it down, I just said, I don't really know, because I'm always a person who's more into sort of individual authors, so I'll be really impressed by an author and read everything of a whole author. And even though maybe each one of their books doesn't stand above other books by other authors, just their complete work or a full series would. But I was in the course of writing the email back to this guy. I haven't got a note of his name here. I made up my list of top five favorite science fiction novels, although this is from about a week and a half ago, and of course I've changed my mind since then. But this list it shows different stages and different styles of what science fiction can be. So if you're interested in this, here we go. Oh, not in any order either. So well, they're just five books that I really, really like and have read multiple times each. First of all is The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, because that's one of those sort of original science fiction books, sort of one of the first, like I'd say, modern science fiction. Again, I say modern science fiction. It's 100 years old, that book, but over 100 years old now, I guess. But yeah, it still sits there as one of the great works. Also, another one, another earlier science fiction from about 50 years later, I guess, is Have Spacesuit Will Travel by Robert A. Heinlein, one of my favourite sort of space adventure kind of books. It's one of Heinlein's juvenile novels, which I quite like. Next up, I guess, would be Ian M. Banks, a bit more recently, again, sort of player of games. I haven't reviewed that one. In fact, I don't think I've reviewed any of the books on this list yet for this podcast. And again, it's a bit like the previous book I just mentioned, Player of Games and Have Spacesuit Will Travel. Maybe it's because I like both of the books, because they're very similar in some ways. I guess if you read both of them, maybe you'll be able to notice some of the similarities in them as well. But what I really like about Player of Games is that it's quite a short book, and that it because it's sitting in an existing world, in an existing established universe, you can sort of cut right to the chase and explore like lots of themes in different ways and lots of ideas in different ways, which I really like there. Another book which isn't a short book, which is David Zindel's Neverness book, which is just big epic sci-fi. Especially if you include like the following trilogy, there's like four books in the Neverness kind of series there. Certainly not for new science fiction readers though. It's quite a lot to get your teeth sunk into, but if you want something which is very deep and a big sprawling world, a bit like Dune in that way, I would suggest Neverness by David Zindel. And again, the final book, I guess, would be Verna Vinge's Fire Upon the Deep, mixed with or combined with his other book set in that universe, which is A Deepness in the Sky. Those books, lots of mind-boggling technology, lots of kind of post-singularity kind of stuff going on there, and a really interesting look at technology which is advanced enough to be magic, plus there's lots of weird aliens, really interesting aliens in those books as well. So I guess those, like I say, it's a big wide range of science fiction there, and I'd say if anyone wants to get a sort of view of what I like about science fiction, probably those books would wrap up what I like about science fiction. And also, I'm thinking actually, because of this email, I think I might actually go through and review every single one of these books in a series of five podcasts as some of my favourites. Because to be honest, I reckon I could probably review them all without reading them again, because I've read all of them at least twice, and some of them many more times than twice for example, War of the Worlds and Player of Games and Have Spaceship Will Travel and Fire Upon the Deep. Read all of those books multiple times. Anyway, so keep sending in your feedback and keep sending in your book suggestions. I keep getting more book suggestions and other people saying, oh, I started listening to your podcast because of this. Keep sending those things in. So anyway, let's get on to a little bit of my recent news. Pretty much the reason why it's been 3 weeks since, or about 3 weeks since the last review that I've posted. One of the reasons is that I've actually started writing another novel, or another novella. I'm about 20,000 words into it so far, and having a lot of fun. One of the main things is that I like about it, compared to the previous book that I wrote, was that it's set on another planet. Humans landing on another planet. It's a bit of first contact, alien, monster kind of things going on there. Another thing that I like about it, because I'm not interested in writing any kind of books which are the kind of books that I've read before. I want to, of course, do new things, because if I'm just going to, you know, have stories or the forms of books that I've read before, there's not much point in me reading them, because I can just read other people's works. And what I'm really interested in writing in a kind of viewpoint kind of way of writing, which I've not seen before, and that is two individual first-person narrators talking to each other, so it becomes also second-person narrative at the same time. So I've got two people in a room, and one chapter's by one person, and one chapter's by the next person, and of course, a lot of the time it's like, I did this, and I did that, and we did this, but other times it's like, oh, and while I was doing this, you did this. And this is a bit influenced by, I guess, well, I was just trying to think of some, you know, another author that I've done, or I've seen this done by, and that was Ian Banks, not Ian M. Banks, Ian Banks with his book called The Keep, I think it is, and it's someone talking to someone else, but it's only one person talking to someone else, whereas here I have two people talking to each other. Again, if you've seen this kind of narrative kind of viewpoint used in another book, please email me about it, luke@juggler.net, and with any other feedback you've got, because I'm really interested to see if this kind of thing has been done before. I can't imagine it's not been done before, but I'm having a lot of fun writing in that style. Another reason why it's taken me a long time to review this book is, and I've said this before, is if I'm not really getting into a book, it takes me longer to read. And the first part of this book, I was really flying through, and the next parts of it was just slow going. And the third reason is that I've just been really, really busy with holiday and with work. At the moment, I'm in Africa, down in Tanzania, on the island of Zanzibar. Because this is, you know, I'm working on cruise ships, and at the moment I've been down to Zanzibar, and I was meant to be going to Mauritius and Madagascar, but there's been an act of God, which was a cyclone coming through, so I didn't go to Mauritius, and then an act of war, which has been some police brutality and riots and people getting shot in Madagascar, so I couldn't go there, so we're having a few days in Zanzibar. The thing is, the internet connection here is really, really slow, so even though I probably have a chance to try and upload this podcast tomorrow when I go back onto the island of Zanzibar again, probably won't work at all. Maybe I'll have to wait for another few days until we get to Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. But anyway, yes, if you're actually interested in my travels and photography and work, I do have another blog kind of journal thing going on, and I'll put a link in the notes to this episode, or maybe just on my podcast website, sfbrp.com, and you can see it there. Anyway, yeah, so I've been really busy, and because I've been away from home a lot before I went away, I had lots of things to prepare, and also because I'm not going to see my girlfriend for a long time, I wanted to get in some time with her rather than recording podcasts for you listeners. Although I have been recording some of the podcasts. If you're interested to hear another podcast that I'm involved in, which is the Friday Night Party Line, I've become a bit of a regular guest host on that. So check out Friday Night Party Line on iTunes and the last three or four episodes I've been part of there. I really enjoy that. If you want to hear me and other people talking about all kinds of things, like you know, some science fictiony kind of things, like virtual worlds and artificial intelligence, technology, you know, there's lawyers and technology experts and economists and all that kind of people who chat there, and there's me, a professional juggler who likes talking about science fiction, is also involved. Anyway, let's get on to the book review. Yes, it has been about 10 minutes since I started the podcast. Let's talk about this book, first published or first written in 1959. Or copyrighted in 1959, it was published in 1960, and it is, of course, Canticle for Liebowitz by Walter M. Miller Jr. Now, I don't actually have this book with me, and I don't even have the notes that I wrote down as I was reading this book with me, because I left it at home when I came away, because I'd already finished it a while ago. So it's actually been a while since I read the book. Hopefully, I wrote down some more notes just now, but hopefully this isn't going to be too vague, although I did go onto Wikipedia just earlier today to make sure I have the facts right in my head. So if this is a bit vague, hopefully it won't be too vague. Certainly won't be too many spoilers. So anyway, it was first published as three short stories, and then it was combined and sort of rewritten and reformatted as a novel. And it was actually the only novel that Miller wrote and published in his lifetime. After he committed suicide years later, there was another novel written that was in the same universe. Thank you to the person who mentioned this as well in an email that I just picked up today as well. So I haven't read that book, but the email from the person who sent me this email said don't really bother with it. He only got about 50 pages into the book. Anyway, it's only about 300 pages long, this book, and it's set in a like post-nuclear apocalypse kind of world after the bombs have dropped. And that's the world that sets up. The thing that happens after all the bombs drop, though, is something called the simplification, where everyone rebels against the people in charge, everyone rebels against the people who have any kind of knowledge about technology, anyone, all the scientists, they're all sort of lynched and killed, and in the end it's all the rednecks out in America who take over, and of course they can't run the country, so everything, it just drops into another dark age. The thing is, there is one man called Liebowitz, this Jewish nuclear technician, and he decides to save as much knowledge as he possibly can. He gets lots of books together, and he does, you know, he saves this knowledge by hiding documents in a monastery, in a Catholic monastery, and he sets up this sort of order of monks, or puts together this kind of mission where the monks memorize and copy literature to save it from the ignorant masses. So that's pretty much the setup. The first story takes place around about 600 years after the nuclear apocalypse, what they call the flame deluge. And the book is still very much Dark Ages kind of level, and it reflects what life would have been like in the Dark Ages in Europe, I guess, around about, you know, 600 years after Christ, say, round about then, I guess. The second story in the book is set 600 years after that, in the kind of sort of scientific renaissance, some kind of renaissance going on there as well. And then the third book is set another 600 years after that, at a time when space travel is once again possible and people are flying to other stars and, you know, once again the world has nuclear weapons. And so it's sort of like a retelling of ancient, or our last 2,000 years of history, set again in the future, again, like Dark Ages, Renaissance, technological kind of age at the same time. And of course, throughout the novel, the main action takes place within the monastery, and within Liebowitz's monastery that he set up, and there's all the abbots and the monks and the priests and the novices, and it's, you know, their task is to keep the memorabilia, which is the documents that Liebowitz has saved. It's their task to keep it safe for future generations. So it all sounds good. The thing is, again, because everything's pretty much set in this one monastery, which is very well described, and there's a lot of life going on, there's lots of, you know, it's very well written, this book. The thing is, it does get a bit dull after time. It's just like, you want action to take place outside of the monastery. And so I was just always thinking, you know, come on, let's get this action going to where the decisions are really being taken, and rather than on these monks who aren't really doing much except sitting on this knowledge for all time. So yeah, let me just go through the individual stories again off the top of my head. Here we have, in the first story, we have a young novice. I can't remember his name. I think it's Francis. Yeah, I think it is Francis. Anyway, so Francis, he is he's not a priest yet. He's not a monk yet. He's out in the desert, and he has to be out in the desert for like 8 weeks or 12 weeks, and he has to sit there and pretty much pray a lot and survive a lot and hopefully find his calling, find his vocation, and that's what he has to do, pretty much just survive out in the desert on some kind of sabbatical, some kind of reflection of maybe what Jesus had to go through before he started his ministries, you know, the 40 days out in the desert. The thing is, he needs to build a shelter to keep the wolves away, and while he's building a shelter, this old man comes along, and the old man helps him make his shelter in a way by pointing out a rock which will fit in this hole in his shelter. And underneath this rock, Francis finds a bunker, an old nuclear bunker, and goes down in there and he finds the skeletons and also finds some other relics, some more of Leibowitz's memorabilia, some of the documents that Leibowitz wanted to save. Although he doesn't really think much about the meeting with the old man. The thing is, all the other novices and all the other priests suddenly think he has met an apparition. There's sort of been Saint Leibowitz, or Leibowitz himself has visited Francis, and they think some kind of miracles going on there. And one of the key sections of this book, which I actually really liked, was the abbot asking the novice, asking Francis, what the story is, because Francis didn't think anything of it. It's just like, oh yeah, some old man came along, this old man, he, you know, and he made this mark on a rock and I picked it up and then it was all happening. Whereas everyone else thinks, oh, of course it was Leibowitz, you've seen Leibowitz. And the abbot is saying, you know, things like, did you really see, you know, was it really just an old man? And Francis is like, yeah, it was. Although now that you're asking me, I'm not really sure. And it's a real sort of like doubt-filled kind of questioning self-knowledge, questioning your experiences, questioning your senses kind of theme going on there in the first book, which I actually really like as a someone who doesn't really live my life by any kind of dogmatic faith. Sort of like recognizing my own perception might be flawed in some way is very important. And of course this continues, and more things happen in the story. I don't really want to spoil the first story too much. It's just that Francis, he does become a monk, and he does get a bit obsessed with the documents that he found down there in the old nuclear bunker down there, and it goes through as well. Of course, the theme of this story, this first short story, because it was published as a short story originally, just as by itself, one thing that I picked up from it was this sort of self-doubt, but it seems to be a bit too much like, okay, what you think is, you know, you should doubt yourself, but don't doubt what you're being told by authority. So don't doubt dogma, but doubt yourself, which is a bit strange. And also another message that I seem to get from this story is that gaining sainthood or beatification or whatever it is for Leibowitz seemed to be more important to the abbot than the core mission of the monastery itself. It's like, oh yeah, it's really important that we save this knowledge for future generations, but of course we want Leibowitz to become a saint, and him being a saint is more, you know, important than anything else. And it's just one of these weird kind of screwed up kind of twisted outlooks on life that the Catholic Church seems to have. It's like, oh, you're not allowed to have you're not allowed to wear condoms, but you know buggering small children, no problem at all, but condoms, really bad. You know, it's that kind of like view of the world, which is just like, I don't really get that. I can't have any kind of connection to this at all. So yeah, that's the first story. The second story starts in sort of like the beginnings of some kind of scientific revolution. There's this prince in this, you know, kingdom's kind of court, who is some kind of Da Vinci figure. You know, he's making big strides in science. Of course, the leaders only want him to sort of come up with new ways of new war machines, of new weapons and things like that. But he's really interested in electricity and physics and optics and all these other kind of things. Yeah, a bit like Da Vinci crossed with Isaac Newton, crossed with some other, you know, scientific greats in the world. And of course he hears about the memorabilia that the Leibowitz monastery has, and he goes, oh, I want to see this kind of thing. So he has to go and visit it, and it's pretty much the story of this guy, I can't remember his name now, but this scientist and scholar who comes along to the monastery and wants to find out as much as possible. The thing is, it turns out the mission of the monastery and the abbot there seems to be a bit twisted, and it turns out that keeping the memorabilia safe for future use can be interpreted in different ways. And here it seems to be that, okay, if a faction is there that is powerful and times are bad, or, you know, the leadership of the world at the moment, like any faction or any kind of kingdom that's in charge is bad in some way, we can't give them the secrets in the past. So it seems like that, oh, okay, we've got this knowledge, but we're not going to share it with anyone because they're not Catholic enough. They're not good enough Christians for us to share any of our kind of knowledge with them. And it was at this point in the book that I really started getting annoyed. I mentioned before about my sort of like disconnect with the outlook of the Catholic faith and the Catholic Church. Here it seems to be getting a bit no, it sort of like really started getting in the way of my enjoyment of the book, because I started disagreeing with pretty much everything that the abbot and the monks stood for. And the book kept casting them in some kind of good light. It's like, these are the main heroes of the book, and what they think, yeah, this is good, that the church should be a moral compass for the world. And I'm thinking, okay, they're the moral compass for the world, but later on in the book we realise that if the priest and the abbot is meant to be some kind of moral compass, what they actually do shows that, hey, wait a second, maybe the moral compass should be something else. I'm thinking maybe like democracy, maybe? I don't know. Maybe if they'd have saved knowledge about democracy and actual good law practices, maybe the societies after the flame deluge, after the nuclear apocalypse, maybe they'd have had a better chance to lead a good life. Maybe the monks and the priests could have used their knowledge, or, you know, they could have actually started up some kind of scientific investigation about it. Maybe have developed their own kind of philosophies and tried to guide these other, you know, kingdoms and, you know, societies that were setting up. But they don't. They just hide the knowledge, as though, like, trying to keep the world in another dark age, or in a longer dark age, is the best thing to do. And I just couldn't understand that at all. They just sort of, like, intentionally, these monks and the abbot is, like, intentionally trying to make themselves irrelevant to the world, so they have as little influence on the world as possible. I just didn't understand it. And the other thing which really started annoying me at this point was that when the abbot said, "Oh, we're preserving knowledge through this dark age," and it's like, we should have, hopefully we'll get credit for this time, not like last time that we were preserving knowledge through the dark ages. And I'm like, wait a second, maybe it's just this character which has got this wrong, but maybe it was Walter M. Miller Jr. himself who didn't understand this. Maybe he's got his history wrong. You know, either way, I find it really, like, insulting and wrong. For a start, here we go. The loss of ancient knowledge was almost entirely down to the adoption of the Catholic faith, Catholicism, Roman Catholicism of the Roman Empire itself. Because pretty much the empire began by relying on, like, a cultural control over its territories, a military control over its territories. The thing is, when it became, when the Roman Catholicism, I can't even say the word now, got it in my head wrong. So anyway, when the Roman Empire went Catholic, let me put it that way, when it went Christian, it started relying on religious control over other people to keep them in line. For example, they would excommunicate people if they didn't do something right. Or they'd say, okay, your soul is going to be eternally damned unless you repent and become part of the Christian faith. And of course that doesn't work, because like the emperors themselves, you know, I'm not going to name any names here, but hey, maybe the ones who actually adopted Roman Catholic, the Catholic faith as the state religion of the Roman Empire, they converted on the deathbed, so they could live a sinning life up until then, and then just go, oh, at the end of my life, now I'll just convert to Christianity, repent of all my sins, and that's it. So it's like, okay, it didn't even work for the Roman emperors, you know, it's not going to work for the rest of the world. And also, like, the answer to all the questions of any kind of inquiry is like, shut up, God did it. It's like the biggest, like, block of science and progress you could possibly get. On top of that, any kind of bickering over the nature of Jesus and the Trinity, that's the kind of thing that continually widened the split in the two Roman empires, the Eastern and Western Roman empires. Like I'm saying, the Roman Catholic Church itself is the main cause of the Dark Ages, or one of the main causes of the Dark Ages. So it's like, don't start going on about saving knowledge throughout the Dark Ages, like, by the Roman Catholics, when the Roman Catholics were the ones who actually caused it in the first place. You know, it was the priests who were destroying knowledge in the first place rather than saving it. Also, the greatest saviors of ancient knowledge throughout the Dark Ages wasn't the Roman Catholic priests and monks and monasteries. It actually came through the Islamic world, who, after, like, they got all the Greek texts from the old Byzantine Empire down in Constantinople and things like that. That's where it all comes through, via the Islamic world, translated back into Latin again, just in time for the Renaissance and going through there. So, you know, all these issues, like, the whole point of this book is that it's showing, like, a cyclic, again, when I consulted this on Wikipedia, it seems to agree with me here, that one of the main themes is showing that, like, the cyclic nature of history here. But of course, if it's going to be cycling history, you might as well get it right. You might as well actually reflect true history, which is a bit weird. History repeating itself, but it's sort of saying, once again, we have the Dark Ages, but I don't know. It's like the whole simplification at the beginning of the book, beginning of the story and the setup of the world, that after the flame deluge comes the simplification. It's like the dogmatic, like, ignorant view that the Catholic Church seems to have. Oh, not so much the Catholic Church, but, you know, other religions as well. Like, that's the kind of thing that would lead to the simplification rather than, you know, anything else. I don't know. So the second story ends again in this kind of cyclic kind of history kind of theme going on here. Ends with a pointless death by one of the characters, much like the first book and the last book, of course. And of course, the killing of the characters, like, shows how bad the world is in this kind of, like, the barbaric Dark Ages, and even in the Renaissance Ages, you know, battling against the darkness in the world. But it didn't really add very much to the book or to the plot. It seems to be like, oh, and at the end of each story, we'll, you know, kill off the main character. And in the first two stories, it didn't seem to really add very much to the book. Okay, getting on now to the third story, the third short story in the book. Nuclear war once again threatens the world because, you know, technology has progressed so far now that there's space travel and all that kind of stuff. So to save humanity and knowledge, the priests and the abbot here in the Leibowitz monastery, they get themselves a spaceship. And the first half of this last short story, the third short story, is pretty much them sort of getting the spaceship ready to take the knowledge and humanity off to another part of the solar system. No, not to the another part of the solar system. They're flying off to Alpha Centauri or some other nearby solar system. The thing is, what are they trying to save? It turns out they don't really care about knowledge or any kind of useful knowledge, not current knowledge, not any kind of current philosophy or any ideas or any technology. What they want to save are these religious relics, the memorabilia, the stuff that Saint Leibowitz saved the first time round. And I'm just thinking, wait a second, why are they caring about this? It's like, if they're really caring about humanity, they'd be saving, you know, current knowledge, current technology, and sort of current history. That would be the most important thing. And also I'm thinking, what kind of people do they want to take with them? And there's big discussions, like, the main point is like, oh, we've got to make sure that we have priests on board, but not just priests, we've got to have abbots on board, so an abbot can sort of put in place more priests. And then, but of course, we can't just have abbots and bishops, that's what I'm trying to say. We have to have at least three bishops, and one of them has to have the power to appoint more bishops into the future. And so there's all this discussion going on. It's just like, why do they care about when the world, like, whole of humanity is at stake? Why do they care about bishops? Why don't they care about humanity? And again, it's this weird disconnect where the most important thing to the Catholic Church seems to be, oh, we've got to make sure that there's bishops, and we've got to make sure that, like, if the world is destroyed, we can have a new Vatican out on Alpha Centauri. And I'm just thinking, I just don't care about any of this kind of thing. It's like bishops in space. I don't care. Like, in another book, you know, I should really, like, I made a note, I remember making a note about this, I don't have it in front of me, but it was something like that in another book, there'd be reference some crazy religious sect who, at the end of the world, decide, it's like something out of a Douglas Adams book or something, isn't it? Sort of like, oh, and then they've got the priests at the end of the world who, you know, they've saved up the, I can't even remember what the name of it is, at the big, at the, not the Big Bang Burger Bar, the restaurant at the end of the universe, where they have this sect who's saved their knowledge throughout to the end of the world, the end of the universe, and they're waiting for their savior. It's that kind of thing that's sort of mentioned as a comedy aside in some stupid science fiction book. I'm not saying, you know, Douglas Adams is stupid science fiction, but it's like silly comic science fiction. And here we have a whole three-part novel talking about this religious sect, and it's like, wait a second, normally, like, the hero hears the story of this, like, sect in passing, this religious sect in passing, sniggers about it, and we get a little life lesson for it, from it, and then, but we realise just how pointless religion is at the end of it. And here's a whole book discussing how pointless and how irrelevant and how disconnected from the rest of humanity, and how, like, the mission of the Catholic Church in saving the memorabilia and, say, like, keeping hold of the dogma of the Catholic Church is just being, you know, it's being discussed as though that's a really noble goal, and it's not for me. It's like completely pointless. And the last part of the third part of the book, the third short story here, it suddenly takes a completely different turn and becomes a huge discussion about euthanasia, because, you know, nuclear war is returning to Earth. A bomb hits a city nearby the monastery. And, of course, lots of people have, like, really, really bad radiation sickness, and they're all, like, skin's falling off, and they're vomiting, and they can't walk, and stuff like that. And what happens is the government sets up this law, passes this law, and sets up these clinics where people can commit suicide if they want to, with the aid of doctors. So it's sort of like state-sanctioned euthanasia. There's lots of strict rules saying that, you know, you can't commit suicide by yourself, and you can't let anyone else except one of the doctors in one of these special clinics set up. So it's very, very, like, a technical setup here. Now, one point of this I actually really agree with. It's like, okay, why didn't the government, instead of passing laws allowing euthanasia for radiation sickness, why didn't they instead work on laws to prevent bombs dropping in the first place? And I'm like, yeah, I can really understand that. But the thing is that setting up this law is quite a prudent thing to do. If you've got millions of people all with radiation sickness and all of them actually want to die, and all of them are going to die really, really nasty, painful deaths with vomiting and, like I say, skin falling off and things like that, and all these children who are going to die before they're 1 year old and things like that, maybe state-sanctioned euthanasia is the way to go. I mean, I'm not really sure which side of euthanasia kind of debate I would come down on in this situation, or no, in the real world. I mean, in my own opinion, it's like, okay, if someone wants to commit suicide, go for it. Should doctors be helping out? Maybe. I don't know. It's not something that I've thought about it quite a bit, but I don't think there's any black and white lines here. The thing is, if I had massive radiation sickness, I'd want a doctor to help me die painlessly rather than dying in a pool of my own vomit and internal organs sort of like bursting within me, of course, and I'd want other people to have access to the same thing. The thing is, the abbot in this part of the storyline, he really disagrees with this. So he does everything that he possibly can to stop people who are in agony and so sick they can't even walk on their own, or they're so sick they can't take their own lives at all. And he sort of like does everything he can to stop them, you know, to stop the euthanasia taking place. He blackmails people, and then he organises illegal protests, and then he kidnaps a woman and a child. He even ends up punching a doctor for like no reason except that the doctor is just following the laws, and it's like one of these, you know, really weird things. And at the same time, all this time, he's being presented as some kind of hero, or at least the main protagonist. And it's like, I don't agree with anything this abbot is doing. It's like, I disagree with the end of the book 100%. Now, maybe, you know, this whole thing is set up like, okay, we're meant to disagree with this, or are we? Or maybe it's just questioning us, or maybe we're meant to dislike the abbot and the other characters in this book. But again, it's like, if you're gonna... I mentioned this actually in the review that I did of Black Man by Richard Morgan, otherwise known as 13. It's like, if you're going to make a character unlikable, you've really, really got to make the character interesting. Yeah, they can be unlikable, but at least interesting, because the worst thing is an uninteresting, unlikable main character, especially if I disagree with everything that they're doing, and I think their mission is pointless, and I think the entire story of the book is a little bit pointless in the first place as well. You know, you can't give me that, and you can't expect me to read the book. And then there's a whole, like I say, topic of this euthanasia. It's like, at the end of the book, suddenly I'm like, why is euthanasia, this big theme of euthanasia, addressed at the end of the book at all? I'm just going, it's like, he wants to keep people alive. And it's like, yeah, because it's in the Bible. Or is it in the Bible? I don't even know if it is in the Bible. And then they just keep going, oh, we've got to keep the people alive. We can't have euthanasia. It's unholy. People go to hell. People will go to hell. And I'm just like, oh, for goodness sake. And then at the end of the book, the only justification that I could find for keeping in place this ban against euthanasia that the abbot wants is that maybe one of the people that you kill will be Jesus or Adam or some other kind of religious figure for the next generations, for the new age after the next nuclear apocalypse. Or maybe one of the people who would otherwise commit suicide or be euthanized will see Jesus or meet Jesus. And then I'm like, okay, I understand what's going on there a bit, but then everything, this whole view of what the abbot, because of course the abbot, it's sort of his views against euthanasia come back to bite him in the arse a bit when he also gets radiation sickness, and he's like, oh no, now I've got to endure it myself. And it's like, but this whole kind of him meeting Jesus or having a whole religious experience at the end of his life it only happens because he's like this deranged brain from radiation poisoning in the first place. And I just couldn't understand. Well, I could understand what was being said, and I really liked the ideas that were being discussed in this book, because this book is deep. I mean, there's a lot going on in this book. I'm only scratching the surface of the themes and the ideas and the all the interconnectedness and like the whole world that's being presented in this book. I mean, it's fantastic literature, but it's like it doesn't affect me in any way, because the questions that it's asking and talking about, of course, there's a whole kind of cyclic history kind of thing, but I don't believe that history repeats itself in the same kind of way in this book, because of course it all relies on, you know, that there is going to be a nuclear apocalypse, and that of course humanity will go through the same cyclic process again, and then at the end of this there will be another nuclear holocaust. I mean, that's the whole setup of the book. You can see it coming throughout the book, even pretty much in the first two stories. I'm not really spoiling it there. It's one of the main themes. But again, I don't really see that as, I mean, it's a noble goal for 1959 when the book was written, but now it doesn't have the same impact as it did back then. And again, euthanasia and these other things about state and church, you know, all the themes with science going up against religion. Again, there's some themes here, but the point of view that this book seems to be written from is the Catholic point of view. It is the religion point of view, not the church and not the state point of view, and not the science point of view. So I find it really hard to identify with the messages here, even though I find it quite interesting what's going on here. And that's why it took me so long to read these last few books. It's because I didn't find it enjoyable. Of course, I don't want to always read books to, like, written from the viewpoint that I agree with, but you know, it does help. It does help if literature, you know, if I can identify with something in the book there. So yeah, let's get on to something that I did actually really like about this. There are lots of really good characters in this book. Lots of the minor characters, like I say, in the first story especially, all the minor characters are really interesting. In the second story, some of the minor characters are really interesting as well, like the characters sort of set outside of the monastery, like the non-religious characters, as well as all the characters in the monastery itself. You know, they're all sort of quite well rounded. Even some, you know, like novice who is only mentioned in about two or three lines. It like tells her about a novice who's trying to work a light bulb, and his eyes are really sore after looking at the light bulb for so long. And it's just like you can really identify even with the smaller characters, and I really like that about the book. Except then in the third story, it's just like all of that's completely forgotten. And I just didn't identify with any of the characters in the third book. All of them seem to be a bit irrelevant. Even the character who I would see as like one of the heroes is the doctor. It's just like he was like tried to be set up as some kind of villain, but wasn't at the same time. I just didn't really believe him. But there are some really good characters. For example, the old man who is set up as some kind of wandering Jew character. He's actually mentioned in all three of the stories, and you're thinking, of course, is he the same character throughout? Did this guy actually live for, you know, 2,000 years or something? And I'm thinking, yeah, I think he did. You know, it's sort of like a take on the wandering Jew kind of story. It's like a medieval myth. I don't really understand it completely, the wandering Jew. You know, I think it's sort of like Lazarus mocked Jesus when Jesus was walking on the way to the cross, you know, when he's carrying his cross up the hill to be crucified, and someone mocked him, and Jesus turned to him, cursed him, and said, "Okay, until I return to earth, you will you're destined to wander the earth aimlessly and live for eternity until I return." Again, it's you know, this kind of idea of returning savior and people staying until the very end of the universe, surviving until the end of the universe. It's been mentioned quite a few times in literature, and here it is in this book again, and it's quite an interesting character, especially in the second book. The conversation between the abbot and the old man is quite interesting there. I can't really remember how he comes into the third book, but I know he's mentioned. The poet is also really good. He's like this court jester kind of figure who can say the truth and not be punished for it, but of course he is punished for it, and that's what I actually really like about this, where it's sort of like this court jester kind of figure, which is normally a bit overly used in fiction, where they say, oh, it's somebody, the madman can come in and say what everyone's thinking and get away with it, but in this book he doesn't get away with it, and I quite like that twist. And the other characters that I quite like is the wildlife, the buzzards especially, which are mentioned throughout the book right from the very beginning, like right on the first few pages. It talks about how Francis, the the young novice, is trying to keep away the buzzards, and any time that anything happens, you're given like the buzzard's reaction to it. For example, when there's war, the buzzard philosophers talk to each other and they say, oh well, it proves that there's God, it proves that God exists, because all the time there's lots of food for us here, look all over the place, there's loads of food. And of course they're picking over the remains, like the rotting remains of some battle, and I quite like the way that the wildlife outside, you know, in the desert outside of the monastery, really sort of plays into it. So there's good, lots of good stuff in the book. Things that made me sort of go what, for example, there's the three short stories are very much standalone stories. They are connected in theme, and they're connected in sort of like a shared history, but not connected in any way in plot, except for this overarching plot that takes place in the background. But the thing is, what happens in the monastery is completely coincidental to what happens outside of the monastery. For example, what happens, like I mentioned this before, what happens at the end of the book, the things that the monks are doing with their own spaceship into space doesn't really matter, you know, and all, even in the second book, what happens in, you know, inside the monastery has no relation, no bearing on what happens on the outside of the world, except that sometimes some people come and visit and sort of go, oh, hey, what's going on here? And then they leave again. So that was a bit strange that because I expected like the documents that Francis finds at the very beginning of the book, and he gets obsessed with one of the documents. I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be great, because later on someone else is going to find this document. It's going to be a key to something that happened later on in the book. Nah, doesn't really happen. But yeah, I guess it sort of plays into some of the grander themes in the book. There's a diversion, some short diversions in the book. Like I said before, everything happens within the four walls of the monastery, or just outside, or with some of the, you know, and anything that happens outside of the monastery, it's because one of the novices, or one of the priests, or the abbot goes outside of the monastery and does something there. Except in the second story, where there's a few chapters, or one, I think it's one or two chapters that happen just outside in some other kind of political sphere, you know, hundreds of miles away. And I'm thinking, oh, why was that suddenly put there? Because everything else was described from the point of view, from the viewpoint of the abbot or some of the priests, and then this was described in a different way, and I was like, oh, I didn't really understand why it left the book there. There's this two-headed woman, and again, I can understand why it's been put in there, but I'm just like, meh. Another thing that was really caught me is that it takes, like, I think it's the third story where we get the first appearance by the first female. I think there's some rape victim or something that we see in the second book, but, like, there's no female characters, and only one of them is given a name. And I think this is maybe a reflection of the Bible itself, because, you know, like, if you count up all the women who are named in the Bible, so I think, like, 50% of them are prostitutes, and the rest of them are people who just happen to be the descendants of Christ. And I think that kind of idea is reflected in this book as well. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but this book has got so many layers, so much stuff going into it, that you can obviously read in so much more than is intended, and miss so much more that was intended by the author in the first place. Finally, another bit which made me go, is all the Latin in the book. There's lots and lots of Latin and a bit of Hebrew, and I don't know any Hebrew. The first time that there's a Hebrew character written down there, I didn't even realize it. It just, you know, because I was reading through and it said, oh, and he made a mark on the stone. The old man made a mark on the stone. And it showed what the mark was, but I thought it was like a scratch on the book or some printing error. And then I was like, what was the mark? And then I sort of read, oh, that was the mark. And it was really interesting to see sort of like Hebrew characters used in the book. And I don't even know how to pronounce any of these things. I don't even know which way round to hold the book when I read Hebrew. So it was a bit interesting seeing those things. And they would talk about it as though the reader would understand. In the same way that there's lots of Latin in the book. And even the short stories themselves are named after Latin. And I looked up on the on Wikipedia what they actually meant. I've forgotten now. But there's lots and lots of Latin in the book. Most of it seems to be there just to really portray a sense of religiosity and culture and, you know, history and learning in the book there. So I did like it, even though it sort of passed me by. I think maybe if I actually understood any Latin at all, I'd have liked it a lot more. Got a lot more out of it. So I think that's pretty much all the things I liked and disliked about the book, and all the things that I think is just meh. The themes, I think I've gotten into the themes enough. I wrote down some stuff. Repeating history, church versus state. Again, I looked up on Wikipedia. It seems like these seem to be the main themes that other people get out of the book as well. conclusion, I guess, this book, as I said before, it seems to be really dated. I don't see the worth. I see the book more as a historical kind of work of literature and see the value in it that way, rather than as a book that I would rather read and enjoy now. Unlike, say, those books that I mentioned before, War of the Worlds. I can really look at War of the Worlds and still get a lot out of it now. I think the themes there are still relevant even today, and so many other like historical works of science fiction still have lots and lots of relevance to the world. This book, I was reading it and I was really struggling to find relevance to myself. Of course, there are sort of like, you know, church versus state themes going on there as well, but there's, again, I felt it, you know, I felt I really had to force myself to find any kind of relevance to my life in this book. I didn't get any kind of personal connection to this book as I do to other books. Unlike, for example, what's the date today? The 12th of February is Darwin Day. Happy birthday, Darwin, 200 years old today. And of course, his books still have a lot of like worth and relevance to the world. You can still read the Origin of the Species and you're still like, wow, this really really stands up to time. Whereas I think that even though a lot of things in Canticle for Leibowitz do stand up for time, I couldn't really get a lot of it to myself. So the first story I really, really enjoyed. The first part of the book, really enjoyed. Definitely like 4 stars for that book. The second part, you know, it was really coming down. The third part, it was just all over the place. It was meandering all over the place. So I definitely think the first part of the book is, the first half, the first 2 sections, say, are much better than the last bit. So I think it brings down to around about 2 stars for the overall book. Maybe 1.5 stars for the actual story behind it, but then the themes and the ideas and like the as a work of literature, I can really see the value of it, and I really did enjoy it in some ways, even though I disagreed with so many points. So that would bring it back up again, maybe to 2.5 stars, maybe 3 stars. I think I'll give it 3 stars because I definitely think it's better than average, and it's a lot more ambitious than most science fiction books are. But again, read it more of a sort of kind of like a technical exercise in science fiction history rather than as an interesting read, as a page turner, because it certainly isn't a page turner for me, especially not by the end of the book. So if you disagree with anything I've said, if you've got any other feedback, or if you've got any other book suggestions, or if you've read the second book that he wrote, I can't remember the name of the book, something like Leibowitz and the Horse Whisperer or something. No, of course, I'm just making that up. But if you have any thoughts at all, if you disagree, especially if you want to defend any of the themes of the book, or if you disagree with me liking any of the aspects in this book, email me, luke@juggler.net, and any of your feedback that I mentioned that I wanted at the beginning of the podcast, get in touch with me there as well. Okay, I've been going about 45 minutes. I think it's about time to stop. So thanks for listening and catch you next time. Oh no, I forgot to say, the next book that I'm going to review is Altered Carbon by Richard Morgan. I've read this book before, and I've actually already finished it, because I finished it on the flight down here, and really, really enjoyed it. I'm going to have a lot of fun reviewing this book as well, Altered Carbon by Richard Morgan. You've probably read it already, because it's been out a few years now, and I think it's been quite popular. So anyway, that's the next book that I'm going to review, and then after that I've got more British science fiction favourite authors, Alistair Reynolds again. I found one of his books here in the library on the cruise ship. I really hope I've got enough time to finish reading it by the time I leave the ship in a week's time. But yeah, I'll be reviewing that one in about a week's time as well. So catch you next time.